Dr. Kenneth Vaux of the Texas Medical Center in Houston, Texas, speaks on biomedical issues and reproduction.
But the Southern Baptist Convention, indeed evangelical Christendom in general, is in grave danger of missing the opportunity that I'm suggesting or hinting at because of the fact that we ignore and have a certain apathy toward the issues that we're trying to raise in this conference. And I find it difficult to understand the sense of apathy. Senator Kennedy is absolutely correct when he says that the most important political issues for the remaining years of this century will be bioethical issues. Certainly they're the most important moral issues that we will face. The Roman Catholics have given intensive attention to the issues of sexuality, reproduction, family planning, and family life. But where among the Protestants is the concern for a vision of human life, of human generativity, of living together? Where are those moral impulses that are built upon a biblical sense of the preciousness of bodily life, of life together, and of death in the body? My doctor father in my studies at Hamburg was Helmut Thielicke, and he has felt for many years that the great abdication of evangelical Christendom has been its retreat from the issues of bios and eros, of man's biological life in birth and procreation and in dying. So it is my prayer, and I hope yours, that this meeting will in some sense move us toward the consideration of these questions. In the 10 years I've been working on these issues, this is the first time I've ever been asked to address these issues as a Christian. I've been in all the political forums, all of the national institutes and agencies, and I've never had this opportunity, nor have I really ever sensed the freedom to say it like I would like to say it, like I want to share with you today. Our starting point is religious ethics, specifically Christian ethics. I quite disagree with my friend Bob Reese this morning that we must filter out that common denominator that could be called a natural rationalistic ethic and make that normative in our country. That seems to me to do it, to render absurd the Christian claims for truth. If something is true for a Roman Catholic, it must be true. If something is true for a Southern Baptist, it must be true. A Christian view implies a peculiar vision of life, a radically unique sense of meaning and valuation. But what do we do with this in the midst of a secularized, pluralistic world? One option is a retreat ethic. It's stated sometimes in very shallow terms, sometimes very profoundly, as William Stringfellow calls it, an alien ethic in a strange land. Perhaps this is our task. Perhaps the world has gone so far that this is the only posture to take, an alien, retreat, ghetto, Dead Sea cave type ethic. Perhaps we need to have radically different senses of the meaning of life in these small cells in the midst of a dying culture. Perhaps the thing for the Christian community to do today is to abandon the fallen world to its own folly. This probably would be the preferred option were it not for one fact, that Christ died in the world, for the world, at the hands of the world. He illustrated God's love for the world. He came not to condemn the world, but to heal the world, to save the world. And so our ethic will be rooted in the enduring meaning he brings to the world. He is the ongoing signal to us of the will of God in our crises of decision. He is normative man. He is making a new person, a new community, a new humanity, a new creation. To me, that's the only normative structure upon which a Christian could think about biomedical ethics. Some say that there are no norms, that one value is as good as another, since all are relative. Some absolutize penultimate judgments, codes, social mores, moralistic hang-ups. And in making these absolute, we ridicule Christian ethics in the eyes of the world. Some transmute our basic psychic, emotive, and ideological hang-ups into moralisms and cause the world to say, if that's Christian, count me out. Now, other speakers on our platform have addressed the problems of genetics in broad outline. Others will address abortion. I would like to consider with you an intermediate topic, namely the responsibility we have in the light of this theological context of bringing children into the world, of reproduction. The essence of the Christian ethic in this field, I would say, is the preciousness and inviolability of each person. That would mean each person yet to be born, each person newly born, each living and breathing person, and each infirm and dying person. The radical ethic of Christianity goes beyond this. Even John Rawls knows it in his book on justice, in that there is a particular and intense obligation we have to those who are most vulnerable, the least of these, those in their original position in Rawls' language, those who we are so tempted to consider as burdensome. This demands of us, this single value, the measures that we initiate, measures to ensure growth and opportunity for each life, and negatively it prompts prescriptions, limiting violations, and harmful manipulations of persons. Now I want to talk about the problems of reproductive biology today. First, I want to tell you a little case. You've read it in the newspapers. I think it's paradigmatic. It speaks to the situation that we are all in. In the little northern Italian town of Stevezzo, Italy, a moral anguish now grips the hearts of many young families. Recently, a dangerous cloud of poison gas was released over a chemical company just north of Milan. People knew something was wrong when the mice, and then the cats, and then the dogs started to die. We always send in the animals before us. Allow a bird to fly down into a mine, and If the bird comes flying out, you know it's safe for men to go in. If not, you check it out some more. Almost like Genesis in a way. But very soon, many of the young mothers, particularly those who were pregnant, became exposed to this gas, and for the most part, they are devout, rural Roman Catholics. But now they face the possibility that the life they carry in their body may be adversely affected, slightly or greatly. And each nuance is something I would say that is representative of the dilemmas we face. Incomplete knowledge. Several mothers have already gone to Milan for abortions. Others are torn in their conscience over the moral choice they face. The church feels it has to say that it is wrong to have an abortion, even in this case. But we will support you if you feel you must do it. Profoundly ambivalent and torn situation. It points to several things we face now as individuals, as churches, as nations. One is a new burden of knowledge and technology, and I'd like to outline that first. Secondly is a correlative fall from innocence, which is also an ascent into power and responsibility that is terrifying. And then there remains an enduring ambiguity about the choices we face and what is genuinely moral to do. And finally, we have to decide fast, before 5 o'clock this afternoon. That's what real moral choices are like. Consider that outline in the light of these reproductive developments. First, the knowledge and technology. It's been outlined very lucidly by Dr. Stumpf. The technology I sketch to add to his outline is just around the corner. It's partially in use right now, it's partially on the drawing board, but in 5 years it will be routine. Amniocentesis is no longer experimental. It was removed from the list of experimental treatments last spring by the National Institutes of Child Health Development, when after a study of 3,000 women with an equal-sized control group, it was seen that there was less morbidity in those who had amniocentesis. There were less spontaneous abortions, less injuries to the fetus. So amniocentesis is now rapidly becoming routine, especially for women who are older or where there are suspected genetically transmitted diseases. In 5 years, amniocentesis will be a regular part of maternal examinations for all pregnant women. This technique, as we just mentioned in the last hour, along with this endocervical smear, are already being used for sexing, choosing the sex of your children. As Dr. Seidel pointed out, that's a very simple procedure. High school students, in a few years, will be able to sex. Just take a little endocervical smear from a girl who is suspected to be pregnant, and illuminate the Y chromosome with very simple techniques. And you could tell whether the girl is pregnant with a boy or a girl. On the issue of aborting for that reason, it's really a non-issue, because with the Roe v. Wade decision, you can have an abortion for any reason you like. and your presenting reason is never questioned. The genetic tree can be drawn, which will convey certain predictabilities to parents regarding the inheritance of their offspring. Fetoscopy and ultrasound, as has been mentioned, will detect a wide range of gross disorders. Amniocentesis is now being augmented by a procedure called endoamnioscopy, an instrument which is inserted transvaginally, which takes not only cells, which are sloughed off the fetus, into the amniotic fluid, but gets a blood sample from the little shoulder of the fetus, and enables a wide range of chromosome and cell studies. That's the technique and the technology, genetic knowledge combined with these antenatal diagnostic technologies. What will they yield? Eventually, multifaceted tests, and I've checked this out just this past week, with the people in perinatal medicine here in Houston, in Boston, and they say that this will very, very soon be going on to multiphasic screening, and this is what it will yield. Down syndrome, the extra chromosome, that mild or profound type of mental retardation and multiple birth anomalies that fills 50 to 70% of all our institutions for the mentally retarded in this country. The Richmond School in our city has 1,500 residents, of which 900 are Mongoloid children, or as they say in the Orient, Caucasoid children. And remember, all you can find is the chromosome abnormality. You cannot say whether this is a profoundly diseased child or one who will be able to go through university and become a professional person. And the same is true with the sex discernment, where there's sex-linked diseases. A growing list of inborn errors of metabolism, single gene disorders. Dr. Stumpf mentioned the neural tube defects. When there's any little hole or little aberration in that neural thread as it's developing, it throws off proteins called alpha fetal proteins. And when you find that, you can suspect anencephaly, meningomyelocele, spina bifida. Sometimes you're right. Sometimes you're wrong. Sometimes it's a wee little hole low in the spine. Sometimes it's a big hole high in the spine. But all you see are these proteins. And that's just the beginning. The polygenetic disorders are beginning to be studied and show markers that can be diagnosed when it's just in the fetal stage. You know what the polygenetic disorders are? Just about everything that you and I have. And it will bring you your death and my death. These disorders have variable penetrance. Sometimes they go through and are devastating. Sometimes they do not. Sometimes they yield only a predisposition to disease. Sometimes the disease presents itself. Carcinomas of the breast, to take one of the major diseases that affects women, is clearly genetic in origin, has genetic factors. Diabetes, arthritis, many, many forms of cancer, heart disease. People in our center now are honing in on the lipoprotein diseases, where something in your genes hampers the way that you process blood fats, so that these things build up. And one day, soon, we'll have readings of whether this fetus is likely to have a heart attack in his 30th or 40th year, or develop childhood cancer, or diabetes. Now, these are very subtle markers, and the scientists among us will remind us that perhaps these are more evasive and futuristic than I'm suggesting. But I'm very impressed by the years I've worked in this literature to see how quickly even the most conservative estimates are wiped out. Even a fly-by-nighter like Gordon Rattery Taylor in his book, The Biological Time Bomb, said by 1975 we will be able to choose the sex of our offspring. He was several years off. He was too conservative. And that's generally the case in science, particularly biomedical science. Each of these problems presents a specific set of questions, along with the generalized issue of selective abortion. And you know the question. Is it worth spending $15,000 to discover one fetus with Down syndrome? Should we screen for carrier status in Tay-Sachs disease? We started massive screening programs in every big city for sickle cell disease, and then we dropped them because they were absurd. Now we've started massive screening programs in every city with large Jewish populations, including Nashville and Houston, and now we're dropping them. And when you see dozens of 12 and 13-year-old Jewish boys and girls already plagued with the thought of whether that little girl you've just met in the halls at school is a carrier for sickle cell disease before you ask her out to the show. You see the tremendous emotional weight of this new knowledge. And we're up again against kind of biblical senses of the burden of knowledge. It's exhilarating and liberating force, and its terrifying weight that draws you down into hell. Should we abort normal males in sex-linked situations like Duchenne's muscular dystrophy or hemophilia? One of my good little friends is 5 years old now. He's in a bubble in Houston. He has one of these sex-linked things, combined immunodeficiency disease. Little brother born a year before him had it. And like all down through the ages, at about 6 months of age, he started to get develop massive infections after the maternal residue of immunity wore off. And he didn't have any defenses. By the time he was rushed into the hospital, he was too far gone. And so when little David was born, they were ready for the bubble. And David's been in that bubble ever since. He may come out. NASA's building him a portable bubble, space suit. But that kind of cramps your style. David's parents and almost all other parents with this situation have decided not to test, not to want to know, and not to save. It's a very interesting day we live in. Kind of coming around in a circle. Kind of tempering our passions for conquest. One other slight addition to Bob Reese's comment this morning on heart transplants. That was really not Frankenstein-like experimentation. Not that Bob implied that. The reason heart transplants went into a moratorium is $25,000 to $50,000 price tags. And people just stopped coming. And medicine today is giving a lot of parties to which people are not coming anymore. But you see the point. We are going to be presented with a partially colored portrait of the child that we must now choose to bring or not to bring into the world. And it's like those parents in Italy. It's only a very fuzzy picture with very little accuracy. And all kinds of relativities regarding both time and space and penetrance we're coming in today when we're all going to get to know what it means to be truly moral, which means completely bewildered. Policy questions are also profound. Do our gonads belong to us or to future generations? These tort for wrongful life suits that Dr. Stumpf mentioned are very interesting illustrations of our grappling in the law of whether we have exclusive control over future generations. Do we have an unlimited right to populate this planet? Do we have any right to exert birth control? That's an interesting question some are asking me now. Another biggie. Should we begin to see genetic disease as communicable disease? CDC this summer, right down the road from you in Atlanta, recently a little humbled by the Philadelphia fiasco, has declared that genetic disease is communicable disease. It's transmitted even more predictably vertically rather than horizontally, like syphilis and measles. And therefore, it should be quarantined. I remember when my brother and I were sick as young boys, the public health officials came and put a yellow sign up in our window that this house was quarantined. Do any of you remember that? So we don't do that too much anymore. Some are saying that any measures necessary should be taken to ensure that genetic diseases are not transmitted. And think back now about the range, the spectrum of things that are genetic disease. What does that mean? Now I'd like to move to the emotional weight of this new knowledge and the moral ambivalence it creates. How are we going to use these new powers? We are learning very rapidly today how to keep a creative tension in our lives between resistance and acceptance, between conquering those forces that hurt us and destroy us and accepting them. And so medicine at its root forces us to do theology again. Dietrich Bonhoeffer once said, "We must learn to resist fate as resolutely as we learn to accept it at the right time." Teilhard, in a slightly different way, says we must struggle against death with all our force, for it is our fundamental duty as living creatures. But when, by virtue of a state of affairs, death takes us, we must not object, but in a strange paroxysm of faith in life, abandon ourselves to death as if falling into a greater life. It's learning to live with that tension, that paradox, that I think is the ethical challenge we face today. A young woman came into my office several weeks ago. Her husband was a medical doctor, and for some reason their marriage was not going too well. After exploring whether this was just a routine occupational hazard, the woman poured out that she was not ready to commit herself. She was not ready to invest and buy a home. She was not ready to have children. She had trouble generating any self-esteem or sense of purpose. And I tried to get at what she was talking about, and she skirted and rationalized, and finally, under pressure, she blurted out how her father had committed suicide in a state mental institution after many years residing there as a paranoid schizophrenic. She assumed that the same fate awaited her. And she was not willing to invest herself in any risky thing, even life, because of what she suspected about her genes. She had genetic hypochondria. It's a major disease in America today. We've all known Jewish or black friends who, during those unfortunate days of mass required screening, were so scrupulous about their genetic attributes that they were hesitant to enter into any human interactions. A very wise man named Caspar Nagel once said, "Health flourishes best when watched least." And a much wiser man said it differently, with a much richer meaning, of course. "He who saves his life." The second point in this emotional burden of ambiguity is the incapacity we have to accept pain and abnormality. The desire for perfection, Dr. Stump's last point, I think is very human. It's very much rooted in our, well, who we are as biological creatures. Bentley Glass touches a very deep feeling in us when he says that children have the right to be born normal. But what does that mean? Sit around the men's smoker outside of the delivery room, as many of you have done, and share the sigh of relief and joy when the nurse says, "The baby is okay, and so is mom." But this natural and wholesome yearning for health and well-being is pushed to the absurd when we yearn for perfection. In fact, we know enough about disease now, particularly mental disease, to know that if there's anything like perfection, or if there's anything like intensely superb human nature, it's very close to what we define as illness. So what are we going to do when we identify in utero human beings that will develop diabetes, cancer, heart disease, schizophrenia? I'm afraid that our initial response may be a wholesale slaughter of unborn innocents. I'm not a right-to-lifer. Usually they attack me. But this one thing I've learned, and I feel they may be right. As long as we are obsessed, as we strangely are in this nation, with utopia, think how radically we've had to change our idea of what it means to have a child with Down syndrome. Primitive German language, a child with this disorder was called the Geschenk Gottes, the gift of God. Likewise, in Ireland, he was called the Dine la Dia, God's gift. Now the child is seen as a tragic mistake. We didn't have the test in time. Or as the woman at Hopkins said, "You frittered around, and you didn't give me the amniocentesis. The kid's yours. We're going home. In 15 days, the doctors and nurses were forced to watch that child starve to death because of duodenal atresia, a knot in the gut, part of the syndrome sometimes. A loss of innocence, a fall from innocence. Trisomy 21, a mutation. So we're again thrown back to our theology of health and disease, our theology of suffering. Will our passions for convenience and comfort and our shallow definitions of what is subnormal continue to prevail, or will we recapture some sense of the infinite preciousness of each person, relatively deformed and diseased as we all are? And learn to watch with care over one another. That's the issue. The theological issue is one of the most problematic. It's whether we can, in some sense, come up with some reinterpretation of all theology till the 19th century, which said that pain and disease were visitations of God. Or C.S. Lewis says, suffering is the megaphone of God. He calls you through this instrumentality. Tillich often said it. I think the best way I can conceive this theodicy question, he says, God does not cause disease, but nothing happens to you that has not passed before his eyes. First studies are coming in now on the use of these technologies. Journal of Medicine this spring reports a cohort of 100 amniocenteses, on which 53 women were pregnant with boys and 47 with girls. One boy was aborted. 29 girls were aborted. Don't kid yourself and think that male chauvinism is a male syndrome. The neonatal questions are always more difficult. Once a child sees the light of this world, once parents and nurses have touched the baby and have held the baby, you have a very different story. You know the anguish of Ray Duff and his colleagues at New Haven. We must be able somehow to endure the weakness of parents who are unable to accept the birth defected child and find some other way to nurture and parent this child. More importantly, we have to find some way to energize the strength of our families to be caring and to be supportive. So biomedical ethics, when all is said and done, falls right in the lap of the churches. That's why your meeting is so critical. I'd like to close with a very famous prayer that seems to me to capture this blessed sense of being at once inquisitive and conquering and trying to overcome those forces so inimical to our well-being, and at the same time accept the blessedness of the given. Lord, give me the courage to change the things that can be changed, the patience to accept that which cannot be changed, the wisdom to know the difference. Thank you.
We have a few minutes now for questions. Introduce yourself and give us your question. You'll be first. No question. Can't believe this. Mr. Jim Young.
I guess the main thing, Jim, would be to find some ways to strengthen the staying power of people in this very demanding world that we're entering into. And beyond that, to find ways to bring circles of support and community to people. It involves challenging this devastating mentality in our own country of isolated nuclear families. Biomedical ethics, when it boils down to people having to make decisions pretty quickly when they're sick. And all the work in biomedical ethics has been done so far by very sophisticated think tanks and the leading journals in philosophy and law and medicine and the firing line is the church and the hospital and the home and the most important biomedical ethicist is the minister. If he's part of the answer rather than part of the problem. Unfortunately, he or she is usually part of the problem. Oh, that's a quick answer.
Yes.
Would you spell that out a little? I heard the... here, I felt some tension this morning when Dan McGee was developing this point of the theology of creation. I would take a little different with him. I do not believe that all human invention and ingenuity is co-creation with God.